Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Thanks for coming in, Mrs. Price. The seventh grade counselor closed her office door and sat down to face her guest. Is there something wrong with Penny? Mrs. Price nervously clutched her purse. She seems to be keeping her grades up, and she's working hard to learn the music for the orchestra's concert next month. Her grades are fine, the counselor assured her, and we're looking forward to hearing her violin solo at the concert. But there's something I've noticed that I wanted to discuss. Mrs. Price stiffened. Penny seems to be losing weight. Is she eating well at home? Mrs. Price's eyes filled with tears. No, she nearly whispered. She's not eating well. She's hardly eating at all. When I tell her it's time for dinner, she says she'll be right down and then keeps making excuses. She sighed. I am worried. Well, I've noticed that she doesn't seem to be in the cafeteria when her friends have lunch, the counselor observed. And when I spoke to Penny, she said she was just too busy right now.
Oh, dear, Mrs. Price began. What can we do?
Have you spoken to Penny's doctor yet? A checkup appointment would be a good idea.
Yes, Mrs. Price replied wearily. It would. I just have to convince Penny to take the time to go.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about eating disorders in youngsters? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We have two guests with us today, both from a hospital that treats adolescent eating disorders. Dr. Gary Litovitz, a board-certified psychiatrist, is the medical director of Dominion Psychiatric Hospital in Falls Church, Virginia. He maintains an outpatient practice of psychiatry with a special interest in the treatment of eating disorders, anxiety disorders, and mood disorders. He's a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University and has written and lectured extensively on a variety of subjects, including eating disorders, self-injury, obsessive-compulsive disorder, phobias, panic disorder, and depression. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Litovitz.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Rebecca Berman is a licensed social worker. Her passion for empowering adolescent females has led her to Dominion Hospital, where she is an active member of the Eating Disorders and Self-Injury Treatment Team. We're glad to have you with us, Ms. Berman.
Thanks for having us.
How can a parent tell if a child has an eating disorder?
Well, there are different stages of symptoms. And before things become obvious, there are often some early warning signs. For example, if a youngster seems to be becoming more and more preoccupied with appearance or with weight, and I'm going to say she because 9 out of 10 individuals that have eating disorders are girls, 1 out of 10 would be boys. So pardon me for just referring to her all the time. But if a girl starts weighing herself frequently, starts changing her diet with more and more focus on healthy eating or preoccupation with the content of foods or the fat grams or the calories, those are examples of warning signs. Also, an increase in exercise and a compulsive aspect to the exercise. And what that means is not only the quantity of it, but if a youngster gets anxious when she can't follow her daily exercise routine, that would be a sign of compulsiveness. And then other changes in eating or food preparation habits, such as a sudden decision to become a vegetarian for no apparent reason, or an increased preoccupation with cooking or baking, preparing food for others without eating it oneself. All of those are examples of early warning signs that might be present even before the obvious symptoms of an eating disorder.
What are the different kinds of eating disorders? I have a feeling that there are several different types, and we sort of need to gear into those. Can you describe them?
Yes, and that is an area of such confusion that I find even doctors are often confused about the different diagnoses. And I think it's really helpful for parents to understand that there's a lot of overlap between the different symptoms and the different syndromes. And so if they're confused about it, they shouldn't feel bad because a lot of professionals are. But it's really not that complicated. There are two basic types of eating disorders. One is called anorexia nervosa, and the other is called bulimia or bulimia nervosa. And in the pure forms, they are very different, but very commonly there's a lot of overlap. One can think of the anorexia type of disorder as one primarily characterized by weight loss. If there isn't weight loss below a healthy weight, then it's probably not anorexia. But weight loss alone is not the only symptom. Losing at least 15% of one's healthy body weight or beyond would meet the diagnostic criteria for the weight loss of anorexia. But also there tends to be what we call body image distortion or a distorted concept of what one looks like, meaning a girl often feels fat and overweight even when she's thin or underweight. And there's a preoccupation with eating, weight, weight loss, body and calories. And finally, there is generally an absence of menstrual periods. If a girl stops having her menstrual periods or misses more than two menstrual periods, that would meet that criteria. Now, this is a little technical, but I just want to mention that a lot of people get a false sense of security that they haven't lost their menstrual periods when they're taking birth control pills or hormones. And if that's the case, then one can't look at that criteria because it is covered up by the use of birth control pills. So that's the anorexia form. The other type is bulimia or bulimia nervosa, which is characterized by binging, eating massive amounts of food or abnormally large amounts of food in a short period of time, feeling overwhelmed, and doing something to compensate. Usually that compensation would be what we call purging, which might be by vomiting or abusive laxatives or fluid pills. But sometimes the compensation might be simply by skipping meals or exercising more and more. And so it doesn't necessarily involve purging, and that's a form of confusion for a lot of people. So the bulimia nervosa form, think of the binging as the key part, and the anorexia nervosa form, think of the weight loss.
One question I have is overeating or binging that's not bulimia another kind of an eating disorder?
Interestingly, overeating such as compulsive overeating generally isn't treated very much by psychiatrists. It tends to be treated more by internists and medically supervised weight loss programs. There is a form of overweight that can come from what's called binge eating disorder. And that would be somewhat like bulimia because the binging is present and very similar, but without the compensation behavior. So therefore, there typically would be weight gain.
Ms. Berman, are certain types of youngsters more prone to eating disorders than others?
As Dr. Litovitz mentioned, eating disorders are much more common in females, although we are seeing an increase in males. Primarily, eating disorder individual can often be characterized as a perfectionist, wanting to please everybody, do everything correctly. In addition to that, they're usually involved in many activities and can be highly achieving in those activities. So you might have a parent who doesn't understand why their kid has an eating disorder because, you know, they're getting straight A's, they're the captain of this sports team, they're doing this community service, all these extracurricular activities, they have so many friends, they're perfect, how could they have an eating disorder? And so that's kind of a common story that one might get. A lot of times they're often in an environment where it's not safe to talk about feelings or share things going on in their life that are personal. They have to create their own outlet. They might be in an environment where there's a lot of things that feel out of their control, so they're looking for other aspects in life to control, such as their weight. It starts off a lot of times as a focus on the weight and the food, and it becomes a lot more than that. And then certain individuals that are pretty involved in specific athletics that focus on body. So, for example, gymnastics, ballet, figure skating, swimming.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on eating disorders.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking about eating disorders in youngsters with Dr. Gary Litovitz and Ms. Rebecca Berman.
Are eating disorders ever symptomatic of other illnesses or disorders?
There's something we call comorbidity, which means two things go together. And that's actually very common with eating disorders. I'm not quite answering your question because it's not clear whether it's symptomatic of or whether they both go along together. But very commonly, these individuals suffer from depression or anxiety. And then issues like low self-esteem or feelings of inadequacy are also very common. And the eating disorder may be a way of trying to compensate for that feeling. I just want to give an example of something that Rebecca was talking about. She was talking about, particularly with anorexic individuals, often they're model children, they're very eager to please, and they're just wonderful children that everybody is so proud of. And parents wonder, well, how could this happen to my child? And I remember a mother calling me once and saying, that the pediatrician had told her to call me because he thought her daughter had anorexia nervosa, but she was sure he must be wrong because she's always been a perfect child.
Oh my.
So I thought, well, that fits. Yes, that fits. And so it doesn't mean that the children are being bad or that they're doing this on purpose. In fact, this is a condition that often comes from people trying to be better and trying to please and trying to be so good at everything they do that it just gets out of control.
Is this something, by the way, that hits at certain stages more often than others?
The peak onset seems to be between ages 10 and 25. That's a little bit misleading, though, because we often will see adults who have had it for a long time. So even though the onset might have been when they were 18, you know, they're 40 when they come to treatment. Sometimes they've been in treatment for a long time and the treatment maybe hasn't been successful. And other times they've been able to kind of hide it or compensate enough that they escaped getting pushed into treatment. And then it's discovered that they have it at an older age. But typically that is the age group. Now, one of the things that's disturbing is that we're seeing younger and younger people developing this. And we've gotten calls from elementary school counselors saying that they're seeing epidemics of bulimia in fifth and sixth graders, and they worry that there might be social contagion, that, you know, it might become a fad or something like that. But I think this weight consciousness in girls is creeping down to a younger age so that even children are looking at themselves in the mirrors, asking if they're too fat, wondering how their clothes fit, and the kind of things that we used to think would really be more common in a 15, 16-year-old.
What's the usual pattern for a girl with an eating disorder?
We tend to talk a lot about anorexia, but it's actually less common than bulimia. Bulimia is probably, I don't know, would you say maybe 10 times more common than anorexia, approximately. And the typical pattern of onset of bulimia would be starting with dieting of some sort or an effort at dieting and having that dieting lead the body to craving calories, craving carbohydrates, which then leads to binging. Most of us have heard the advice of not to go grocery shopping when you're hungry because you spend way too much money and you buy bad food. And if you think about why that is, it's because you're so hungry and you're just feeling the urge. You've got to get something to eat and you're not going to make good judgments. Well, if a girl starves herself in the morning trying to get up and be strong and lose weight and just eat a half a grapefruit for breakfast and then the other half for lunch, and by afternoon, she may be so hungry or her brain may be craving calories that she starts binging in the late day. So that's a typical pattern of onset for bulimia. But also, it's not just hunger or food-related behaviors that lead to that. It's also feelings. And for many people, the binging and purging may be an outlet for feelings of loneliness, depression, anxiety, anger, or other kinds of frustration.
Or a lot of times, too, the feelings are so intense, maybe more than one might normally experience. And so there's a desire to then release those feelings in some way. And so you think of getting them out and at times also feeling so lonely that you're putting so much in, and then the feeling of fullness gets so uncomfortable that then you want to put those out. So the food and the feelings are really symbolic.
Everybody is having a hard time developing and dealing with the stresses of adolescence and the social pressures and fitting in and forming one's identity and developing self-esteem. It's just a very difficult time. And our culture and society has not made that any easier. If you think about the messages that are being delivered by the media. Now, fortunately, you all are off the hook because radio doesn't send visual images of thin women, but magazines and TV and movies are holding out these images of models that girls then look at and think, well, this is what I'm supposed to look like or else I'm a failure. Yet what they don't know and rarely hear is that 80% of fashion models achieve their weight by unhealthy means. They may have eating disorders themselves. They may be abusing diet pills. They may be compulsively exercising. And so they're presenting an image that doesn't necessarily come naturally or normally and can lead to this feeling of insecurity and this sense of failure. So I don't think we need to postulate that somebody is particularly disturbed or in a very disturbing life situation to fall victim to this kind of pressure.
How do parents unwittingly influence or enable eating disorder-oriented behaviors?
I think it's really important to look at the environment, the dynamics of the family. You can't just pinpoint it's definitely because of the media or it's because of the family or it's because of this experience at school. A lot of times a combination of many things. But at home, it is really important for parents to be aware of their own relationship with their bodies and with food, that they're, you know, setting their role models. And so if they're constantly making comments about being on the latest diet or even asking their kids if they look a certain way in something, it's creating that environment as well. In addition to parents sometimes setting unrealistic expectations. So you have somebody who's already a perfectionist now wanting to please even more and thinking that getting straight A's is still not enough. So they're looking to please in so many different ways, and that to be perfect really is unrealistic. And so you're kind of setting somebody up then for failure if you're expecting them to be perfect.
What should a parent be doing if a child comes to the dinner table when called, says, "I'll be back in a minute," leaves the table, and doesn't come back to join the dinner? And this happens day after day.
The whole question of family involvement in treatment is changing now. And I think that the thinking amongst eating disorders experts now is that family involvement is even more important than we realized before. And there are new models of treatment that really emphasize the role of the family. It's a very tricky situation, though, because typically there's a lot of tension, which leads to conflict. There's a lot of anxiety on the part of parents. This is very scary. I mean, they read that children die from this disorder, and they can get very frustrated because it seems so easy. You know, all she has to do is just eat. Or if it's bulimia, all she has to do is just decide not to throw up. That's the thought. I'm not saying that that's true. I'm just saying that's a reaction that people think and have when they look at it, and often don't realize how difficult it is for the individual suffering from this, how out of control they might be. Whatever recommendations that Rebecca and I make, I think, have to be taken in the context of our awareness of how hard it can be and how stressful it can be on the family to try to have these interactions. Given that, the first step, of course, is open dialogue. There has to be open communication, and there has to be a certain strength on the part of parents to tolerate the feelings that are going to come from the child, the upset, perhaps anger, denial, perhaps. The initial reaction might be to insist there's nothing wrong. And parents have to be supportive, calm, understanding, and they have to persevere.
Sandy and I both have grown sons. I remember when they were little being told, don't make a big issue about what they're eating. Just make sure they're eating something. You see children who don't eat vegetables or don't eat fruits or whatever, and we were always told, don't make an issue about it. Offer and just watch and see if they're eating.
Well, you know, I'm not sure I would disagree with that, because we're really talking about two phases of how parents might react. First, we're talking about prevention. To prevent or to avoid setting off or pushing somebody towards an eating disorder, I think the low-key approach does make sense. Mm-hmm. And as Rebecca said, you don't want to be bugging your children about losing a little bit of weight and trying to control them and things mm-hmm. like that. That's really not a good idea. Once it becomes evident that there is an eating disorder or evidence of an eating disorder, then things change. And then we're talking about how does a parent intervene once there's a problem, which is, of course, a quite different process than how does one prevent.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on eating disorders.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking about eating disorders in youngsters with Dr. Gary Litovitz and Ms. Rebecca Berman, who indicated how important it is for parents to be setting an example. A parent may be on a weight loss program. That doesn't mean you carry on about it at home
exactly.
or talk about it at every meal because you don't want the child to think
right.
he or she should be doing it too.
Exactly. And as adults get older too, they have different dietary needs, and some might have a high cholesterol diet or be diabetic. And so they're really monitoring what they're doing, and they might have foods that meet those needs at home, but it wouldn't be appropriate then to be sharing all that with a child so that the child's now learning to be label conscious and all the different types of diets.
This might be a good time to mention a little bit about the difference between boys and girls mm-hmm. with eating disorders, because Rebecca was talking about health-related diets. It turns out that girls with eating disorders tend to focus a lot on appearance, on the number of pounds on the scale, that number is significant, on clothes size, that can be very significant, and they tend to lose weight primarily by dieting. That's number one, with compulsive exercise or overexercise being secondary to that. Boys, on the other hand, often tend to start an eating disorder because of health consciousness, And I'm not trying to say that in any way they're better or more healthy or anything than the girls who have it. But for boys, the anxiety isn't necessarily so much about appearance and clothing size. It tends to be more about trying to obsessively pursue health. It may be a father that had heart disease or something like that that scares them. Or for some reason, they get worried about some sort of health issues. So they start pursuing this excessive fitness and cardiovascular development. And then losing weight becomes part of that in their minds. So that's one difference, the health focus versus the appearance focus. Both get out of control. Another difference is that boys with eating disorders have a more likelihood of doing the compulsive exercise than the excessive dieting. There's a little bit of a weight in favor of that. And then there tends to be more embarrassment about seeking treatment because this is known as a girl's disease, which it really isn't. Boys and girls can get it. And so there's embarrassment about it. There's a little bit of avoidance. And there's a tendency for professionals to miss it because they just don't think of it in men as much as they should.
What happens in situations where there are weight classes for things? I'm thinking, for example, of wrestling. There are a number of sports where you've got to weigh in below a certain amount. And you've got guys who are exercising tremendously so that they can lose that weight.
That's a problem for both boys and girls. And we see the incidence of classical restricting type. That's the dieting type of anorexia, which has been around for a long, long time, is about 1% of girls. But if you look at high-risk groups like ballet dancers, flight attendants, gymnasts, it may be 5 to 7%. So boys and girls have these risk groups that they can get into. For boys, being a wrestler, where there are weight classes, those are high-risk groups for boys. But any sport where coaches emphasize weight one way or another can increase the risk of this. So we try to spend some time in our local area giving talks to school systems, and coaches are often very interested in that to help them understand some of the risks and how to avoid promoting that.
What is therapy like for kids with these disorders?
I think that it's important to keep in mind that eating disorders have a whole bunch of different approaches that are congruent. They're all going on at one time. So somebody who is recovering from an eating disorder and treatment from an eating disorder needs to be seen by a variety of different people. So they're being followed by their primary care physician, by their psychiatrist, they're working with a dietitian and their therapist as well, and they're all communicating and working as a treatment team, which is ideal because there are different specialties, and it's important that the first thing would be that somebody really needs to be medically stable, and so that they're checking all those areas out. In terms of psychology and therapy, the most successful type of therapy has been cognitive behavioral therapy. So that's looking at the distorted thinking a lot of times and challenging those distorted thinking. So for example, somebody that might say, if I am the thinnest, then I'm the best. And so if that's the distortion that they have in their head, that's truth for them, then they're going to keep wanting to pursue that lower weight because who doesn't want to be the best? So it's working on challenging those distorted thinkings, on following symptoms and urges and how one is responding to it, on learning coping skills. And one thing that often gets very tricky is a lot of times people with eating disorders are very intelligent. So they might see the distortion, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to change the behavior. And so the two pieces really need to go together.
What's the prognosis for recovery? I've heard that this is really a lifelong problem once it becomes a problem.
I'm going to be lumping the different eating disorders together when I give you this, if you have specific questions. I think of the rule of thirds. About a third of patients with treatment will fully recover and be rid of the disease. About a third in the middle will have some improvement, but the symptoms may wax and wane and may continue to present some difficulty for them. And then unfortunately, there are a third of people who do very poorly, who either have trouble engaging in treatment, they can't stick with it, or the treatment just isn't working for them, and they continue to have symptoms that can lead to medical complications and serious psychological complications, can interfere with relationships and interfere with professional success. And there are unfortunately also a percentage of patients who die from this condition. For anorexia, which is the weight loss type, it can be as high as 5, 10, and some studies say even 15% of people with the disorder will eventually die from it. What isn't appreciated is that bulimia, the binge purge syndrome, also can be fatal, and that although normally people don't think of that, that the purging by vomiting or other means can lead to heart arrhythmias or other medical problems that can lead to death. So it is crucially important that people get treatment and that they stick with it, because the treatment usually is something that has to be ongoing for quite some time.
Well, this is obviously a subject we could go on and on about, but unfortunately we have to close. And before we do, what resources would you both suggest to our listeners who want to pursue some of these issues further?
Well, the first thing I want to mention, particularly for folks that just want to get a start or talk to somebody about it, is that our hospital, Dominion Hospital in Falls Church, Virginia, has a 24-hour telephone line where someone can call for information, referrals, or consultation. And if you'd like that number, I can give you that. We call it First Step, for taking the first step. And the number is 703-538-2872. There also are some useful internet sites. There are unfortunately some unhelpful and destructive internet sites that patients or children go to, but
which could be a whole nother parent's perspective. One of the ones that I find really helpful would be the National Eating Disorders Association, which is www.edap.org. The other one would be eatingdisordersinfo.com. Dr. Leavitt and I each brought a book in. The one I brought was the Eating Disorders Source Book, which goes over all the different types of eating disorders, causes, treatments, preventions. That talks about different levels of care. That's by Carolyn Costin.
And this one is called Help Your Teenager Beat an Eating Disorder by Dr. James Locke and Dr. Daniel LaGrange.
Well, you have certainly been very helpful to all of our listeners, and we are very grateful, Dr. Gary Leavitt and Ms. Rebecca Berman, for being with us today. Thanks so very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 344. Also, spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Please tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This program has been produced with generous support from the American Psychiatric Foundation. We also need your valuable input. For all respondents to our very brief survey, we have a special gift. Please just go to our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can find show number 344 listed. Click onto the survey shown below that. We appreciate your help. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.